music and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning and welcome to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM, Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded, unsurrendered territories of the Coquitlam, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I am Robin Erickson, and I am your host today. I am joined over Zoom by Rachel Cairns, who is an artist and creator who believes in staying curious and following her bliss. As an artist, she writes, performs, and directs stories that explore the human condition and remind us of the universal spirit that connects us to one another. As a producer and creator, she connects with artists to help them realize their vision, helping them harness their talents to create momentum in their careers. She cut her teeth making short films and web series that have screened at festivals internationally, garnering nominations and awards, and has been viewed millions of times on YouTube. Rachel is the creator of Abortsh, a new podcast series about abortion in Canada that will begin airing on CJSF on Monday, August the 1st at 10 a.m. and will run for 10 consecutive weeks, which I'm really excited about. And Rachel joins me today to talk about the podcast and why we need to hear about these things. So welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
Let's just jump right in and learn about maybe which came first, your desire to create work about abortion or your desire to make art in response to the anti-choice fervor and legislation that's happening stateside?
Definitely the first, just in terms of, you know, my own personal timing. It kind of astounds me that it is aligned with this huge cultural emergency that we're experiencing right now. But yeah, my abortion was in 2019. And that kind of was the impetus of my own personal geekdom about reproductive rights and justice. Yeah.
Yeah. And then funny just how timing works that way, right?
Yeah. Like couldn't have. It was just kind of infuriatingly, unfortunately perfect timing to launch a podcast about this, sadly.
How do you understand the relationship between a woman's autonomy over her body and reproductive rights in general?
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting question because, you know, it's like my honest first reaction to it is like, oh, is this even a question? You know what I mean? Like, it's so fundamental to basic equality. One of the guests I have on the podcast, her name is Rachel Johnstone, and she's a political science professor at Dalhousie. And she wrote a book called After Morgenthaler, which really outlines a case for realizing positive rights recognition and provision of abortion and reproductive rights. Now, this is like we're getting into very like heady political science territory already. basically, like rights kind of fall conceptually into two camps. They can be positive and negative. And a negative right is like a freedom from interference. So, you know, freedom of religion, free speech, those sort of things. That's like a negative right, you know, namely the government does not have the right to interfere with you, your relationship to that right. A positive right is kind of the opposite of that. It requires a bit of a collaborative situation. Like the government has some sort of fundamental duty to help you realize that right. So Rachel Johnstone, you know, her work in this book was really outlining a case for that. Now, that doesn't mean creating a law around abortion. All of the reproductive rights and justice advocates, certainly in our country, is like, that is absolutely not what we need to do. And maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But to address the first part of this question, in Rachel's book, there's a sentence that she has. I'm probably going to botch it because I don't have it in front of me. So, and I don't know if it's, you know, her idea or if she's referencing her own research from, you know, the body of reproductive rights philosophy out there. But she basically says, you know, abortion is the only human right that did not originate as a right granted solely to men. And I think that that is very revealing as to why it is such a controversial and difficult issue for some people to grapple with. For me, it's not. It's very obvious. It's like, I've always been, you know, no duh, we believe in abortion. In fact, you know, parts of my own experience took me by surprise because I had, I think, taken reproductive rights for granted growing up in Canada, growing up on the West Coast, having a very feminist mother, running in very progressive circles. And then these kind of roadblocks or hitches in my own experiences of accessing abortion kind of opened my eyes to, oh, we still have a lot further to go, actually.
Wow. But what you just said blew my mind.
Aww.
about these rights.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And how abortion and reproductive rights are the first rights granted solely to women and birthing bodies.
Exactly. Yeah.
And not men. And so, it just feels like such a devastating blow, really.
Yeah, I think it's really indicative that although we have come such a long way in terms of, you know, equality, certainly my experience growing up identifying like as a woman in the world is very different from my mother's, from my grandmother's, from my great grandmother's, like astoundingly so. But it does open your eyes to the misogyny that we are still deeply steeped in terms of how society operates. So
very interesting though, and good to know, I guess, in terms of, you know, how as people who want to stand in solidarity with you know, pro-choice issues, mm-hmm. That it kind of gives us a little bit of fuel for the machine.
Mm-hmm. Totally, totally.
So always looking for the bright side.
You must.
You were mentioning, you know, that this is one thing that you learned from one of your guests on the podcast. But what else have you learned by undertaking this project? If you can encapsulate it.
Yeah, totally. I think I have two kind of, you know, relatively concise encapsulations. The first one would be, I already kind of felt this, but I think creating the project and, you know, coming up, speaking with the experts and the activists that I've, you know, had the privilege to connect with, it really reinforced for me that so often abortion has been kind of siloed as a stigmatized and taboo issue. And, you know, it is part of the work socially that we have to do in terms of destigmatizing it and normalizing it is really understanding it in relation to the major issues that we are all facing. So, like, on a personal note for myself, I'm I had an abortion, but I'm somebody who wants a family. It was just not the right time for me or my partner or my potential child and future children for me to begin my family. But when I think about the decision to have kids or not, I'm thinking about what my housing costs me and what realistically my partner and I, where we realistically need to be in our lives, even just to like rent a 2-bedroom apartment. I'm thinking about, you know, are we going to be one of those people lucky enough to get a $10 a day childcare spot, or will the supply not be ready enough yet? I think about our environmental policy and the planet that my kids and future generations are going to inherit. I think about, again, as like identifying as a woman, I think about when I time having my kids, if I can, you know, the impacts that that's going to have on my career and my trajectory and how much I earn. We have very solid data that women and people who have children, the more children they have, the less likely they are to be earning the equivalent of what a male counterpart of their age is earning. You know, and these are just issues that directly impact me. There's so many more beyond my own experience to how, you know, Indigenous communities and particularly women have experienced choice in our country presently and historically, and how we really need to be addressing that, to, you know, the abolition of the prison system, to how cities are built, like. And you can all find these interconnections with abortion. So de-siloing, destigmatizing abortion and reproductive rights was the kind of one of the largest takeaways. And the second big takeaway, which it was just very personal to me. Another guest, her name is Sarah Kaplan, and she founded the Institute for Gender and the Economy that operates out of Rotman Business School here at U of T. I asked her, a bit of a spoiler, like the final episode of Abortion is sort of a tell them what you told them episode, where I kind of reiterate a lot of the key messages that each of the guests shared. And I also asked each of my guests to articulate what they felt progress would look like in the next 10 years to really make sure we stay on like a hopeful bent and a productive conversation. And when I asked Sarah Kaplan this, she paused for a really long time. And then she said something to the effect of, you know, I should have a really good answer for this. And one of the reasons that I don't have a good answer for this is because I've been, you know, she's not an economist, but she essentially is understanding how business and the economy works. And her research is deeply in innovation and really understanding the intersections of gendered injustices in society. It's huge. But anyways, she's been doing this work for 30 years. And she was like, if I have seen so little progress, relatively speaking, in 30 years, what can I really hope for in the next 10? And that broke my heart. And then she kind of rallied, and she did offer something, which was basically that she said, if we can somehow normalize caring as something that is essential to everyone's responsibility. And I think she's meaning caring in terms of what we call the care economy, which are traditionally, those are jobs that are literally taking care of society's well-being. That could be everything from like healthcare to cashiers and cleaners and caterers and people who look after kids and are elderly. So people who are really doing the work to take care of society's population and workforce, essentially. And traditionally, women have made up the majority of these industries, and therefore their work is undervalued because also traditionally women generally do this work for free for their own families and kin. So she was just saying that if we can value that, and if we can normalize that as something that we don't just ask women to do for free or for less than they should be paid, we will therefore be reframing how we design jobs, because jobs are not designed with care work in mind. We will be reframing how we look at a lot of policy on a number of levels of society. We'll be looking at how we design cities. You know, it would be a tremendous kind of ideological and cultural shift. So that is something that really stuck with me as a profound shift in terms of how you're looking at how the world works. And, you know, on one hand, it really resonated with me. And it's ever since that conversation, there's a little part of me that's always kind of asked, like, how can you care more? How can I ask for more care for my, you know, partnership, all that kind of stuff. But it's also a little bit, too, of that, like, oh, shit. So often the reality is, you know, people just don't care unless it's happened to you or unless it's personally affecting you. So I've been thinking about that a lot ever since I spoke with her and as the project continues to evolve. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think, you know, one of the blessings of COVID, too, is showing us where those care gaps are, right?
Absolutely.
And so much how women are the largest affected demographic within that realm, and so yeah, we might see a difference, hopefully, out of this all.
I want to see a difference.
Yeah, likewise. before we talk a little bit more, I know that you brought a few songs to share that are really amazing, and I want to take some time right now to listen to one of them. Do you want to tell us what we'll hear?
Sure. Let's listen to Angry All the Time by Lunar Bloom. These are my friends. They're a band out of Toronto. And this is a song off of their first album, which they just released. And I love how it sounds. I think it's got a good hook, and I relate to the feeling.
Guess I'm angry all the time. I can't see why. I can't see why. Yelled at you again last night. Gave me a fright. Gave me a fright. Can't follow the logic to the end of the line. Reasoning ain't meant for me. It's the heart. Scream.
welcome back. That was Angry All the Time by Lunar Bloom, song selection by my guest, Rachel Cairns, who is the creator of Abortsh, a new podcast series about abortion in Canada. And we've been talking a little bit about, you know, what you've learned and what you think reproductive rights look like in general. And I want to turn and ask what your creative process has looked like through this project.
Okay. So I think to kind of describe it linearly, I guess, even from the jump of this, my personal abortion experience, my creative process got engaged. So if you listen to the podcast, it opens with the conversation that I had with my GP when I discovered I was pregnant. And I asked, how do you get an abortion? Basically, I asked, how do you get an abortion? And he asked me a string of questions that were asking me to qualify this choice, which included asking me about my relationship status, how committed that relationship was, asking me how much money I made, asking me how much money my partner made, asking, once he had, you know, ascertained that he felt we made enough money to have a kid, why I didn't want one. And then also didn't tell me really how to get the abortion. So that was quite alarming to me. And while I was in the doctor's office, it was I just answered his questions very directly because, you know, my largest priority and concern was, I don't want to be pregnant and I want to just, you know, find the solution to this as quickly as possible. So I answered his questions in an attempt to be a good patient, to just, you know, not create any friction, to hopefully get an answer that I was seeking, which I didn't. But, you know, so there was part of me that was just panicked and wanting to just, you know, be smart and navigate swiftly. There was another part of me that was very aware that his line of questioning was deeply inappropriate. And I think because I'm an actor and an artist, it sort of ignited a muse in my ear almost, you know, and I'm always a little bit is it a muse in your ear or are you dissociating because you're in a situation where you don't have control and it's your body trying to protect you from potential trauma? Who knows? But anyways, in that conversation, there was a part of me that for whatever reason kind of ignited and was this is a scene with a lot of conflict in it. And then in terms of my own experience, as I waited for my abortion, had the abortion itself, you know, the weeks after the abortion, in my own personal life, there was just a lot of moments where, the part of me that's a writer was kind of my brain would be oh, that's a scene, or what that person just said is really interesting or profound or whatever. So I started kind of for whatever reason, my creativity was attuned to these moments in my life. That were very much related to the abortion. And I also, in my own personal experience of the abortion, first and foremost, I'm very much a abortion is normal. It's not a big deal. It's just a ball of cells kind of person. And that's me talking personally about my own opinions and perspective on it. For some people, it is a big deal and it's totally allowed to be. And also it was kind of for me too, and I had a lot, it was difficult for me to grapple with the reality of that. As I said earlier, I am somebody who wants a family, and I was 31 at the time, so even though it was absolutely the best choice for me, I would not have chosen any differently, there was a part of me that was I feel really shitty that I'm 31, I'm now gambling with my biological clock, and my life isn't together enough to make the choice I would like to make if my circumstances were different. And I felt really bad about that. And I felt really scared about, am I going to be able to get my shit together in the next 5 to 10 years to have one, maybe more kids if I want to, you know? And that was really scary and something that, you know, it wasn't a comfortable feeling to be having. And how I really coped and processed that, for whatever reason, was like devouring information about abortion and reproductive rights. So I started just, that's when I really started kind of almost immediately Googling as much as I could, reading as much as I could, listening to podcasts, like watching movies that were about abortion. Like, it made me feel better. It was like totally a coping mechanism and definitely one very much centered in like control. But it helped me. And then I was collecting all this information and I started to feel like I wanted to organize it again in a creative way. And it first manifested actually as a play, because I, you know, one of the things I do is act. I have a background in theater. Fleabag, we were still like on the Fleabag wave. Like, we were all like high on Phoebe Waller-Bridge's, rightfully so. So when these little scenes were kind of happening, I would often see them in my head as like a woman alone on stage. And I wrote a one-woman show also titled Abortion. But then the pandemic shortly happened, theater died. And I also began to be like, the podcasting medium came to me just because I consume a lot of podcasts. And I also thought that it had the ability to, you know, it was really important to me that although I still love the one-woman show incarnation of this project and hope I can do it one day, you know, first and foremost, even though I share my experience in the project, it's really important to me that I hold space for the conversation beyond my own experience, because I'm only this like one blip on a huge continuum of what reproductive choice means. So the podcast is kind of a better, lends itself better to just holding more space. And just practically speaking, has the potential to reach a lot more people and like around the world. Whereas like you do a run at a fringe festival, you're going to maybe like get 500 people at best. So that happened over the next, you know, over the course of 2 years until here we are today.
You touch on this a little bit in terms of what some of the challenges and the drawbacks have been, you know, COVID interrupting everything. But are there others that sort of arose in putting Abortion together, or things that you faced?
Definitely. Like, I did get a lot of no's, particularly from like the theatrical community, which felt bad. Rejection's never nice. But I also, I'm a hippie at heart. So I also kind of turn those no's into the like, okay, the universe is redirecting me. So, you know, follow that path. And I think the challenges like that are more podcast specific, I don't think anything with like a capital C challenge. I applied for grant funding. That's how I got the money to like make a thing. And I got the grant funding. So big thank you to the Canada Council for the Arts, because they've really enabled me to create this project and I will forever be grateful to them. But of course, you know, you have to know how to do grant applications and you have to have the time to do the grant application. And it's a really long process. Like, it takes a long time to write it, and then you have to wait a really long time until they adjudicate it and everything. So it means things move really slowly. But it was also my first time making a podcast, and I think I was willing to move slowly because I was just figuring it out, kind of putting one foot in front of the other. So I guess it was a challenge just in terms of kind of like, it felt very much like I was grappling through the dark a little bit. But I also enjoyed it. So it was like, you know, lower case challenging, not uppercase challenging.
Anything in terms of the content that was challenging?
I went back and forth a bit about how much anti-choice content I wanted to include, and I ended up basically doing a whole episode about it, and it's like the second episode, and I kind of do that in the spirit of like addressing the elephant in the room so we can also just like get over it and start talking about other things. It's also hard to completely omit anti-choice content, because the reality is there is still a lot of like opposition to abortion, and even though I hate that it's often framed in the context of its opposition, you know, there's still a lot to be addressed there. So that was one thing that I was always kind of trying to be very conscious of and very like mindful of how I was framing it. And then I guess early on, while I was making, back when I was still like making it as a play, you know, nowadays, like every piece of theater I go to see, and rightfully so, begins with a land acknowledgement. And Baroness von Sketch has this amazing sketch about land acknowledgements that often feel like they're kind of boilerplate or some sort of ceremony that is disingenuous and actually not really saying that much. And so I really didn't want my land acknowledgement for my play to be like that. And therefore, you kind of have to sit with what a land acknowledgement means to, you know, myself personally and in relation to the material. And back when I, you know, was kind of just post-abortion, was devouring a lot of research material, I came across a book by Professor Karen Stote called An Act of Genocide. And it documents the history and in many ways ongoing into our present of forced and coerced sterilization in Canada, and also just other forms of population control and, as she says in the title, genocide that have been inflicted on Indigenous communities. And, you know, growing up as a white city kid, it's kind of like, you know, when it comes to Canada and as a colonial state, our relationship with the Indigenous people of this land, it's like I almost just always blanket statement assume it's bad. And this was the first time in terms of, you know, reproductive freedom and choice, I assumed it was going to be bad, but here I was really understanding the extent and the specifics of what we're talking about. And this was also in relation to me kind of crystallizing the trajectory of reproductive rights activism in the country. So the Morgenthaler era, you know, how the legislative legacy was, you know, the timeline of that in relation to my mom's experience. And it was, you know, personally for me, it was this moment, this kind of like Venn diagram moment of two very different realities overlapping, where, you know, my mom and people in her generation are gaining access to better reproductive rights and choice, and Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people are, you know, being forcibly and coercively sterilized, having their kids taken away in hugely disproportionate numbers, being pressured into abortions, being subjected to long-acting contraceptives. And it's like all happening at once, right? And so for me, that was sort of a big starting point for the land acknowledgement of the play, of being like, it's like a tale of two cities almost, you know, like how do you reconcile these very different realities, and what does this mean today, and how do we be better And so as I was writing that, I was like, I need consultation. So I started reaching out to, I just started Googling. I was literally Googling like reproductive justice, Indigenous Canada, like really basic Google searches. And I ended up reaching out to, her name's Claire Dion Fletcher. She's a Lenape Potawatomi midwife. She's the co-chair of the National Aboriginal Council of Midwives. She works at Seven Generation Midwives and here in Toronto. She teaches at a lot of midwifery programs. And she was a huge, huge teacher for me in my own experience of incorporating this really urgent and important conversation in the project. So it was a challenge just in terms of, you know, being a little bit scared, but also knowing that like it needs to be done. I probably will and have fucked it up in some ways, but that's also a part of growing and learning and like humbling to engage in trying to, I guess, you know, your own personal commitment to reconciliation and whatever it means to you individually. So yeah, that was I'll call it a challenge, but again, one that I was knew must be, you know, engaged with.
Yes, thank you. That's really precious. And to see the link between the land and our bodies, right?
Absolutely. Also,
and how those two inextricably connect, and you know what justice means in the grand scheme of things in terms of that. So I think this is a good time to take another song break. Do you want to tell us what we'll hear in this one?
Sure, yeah. Song number two is called Racist Friend. It's by a band called Me, Mom, and Morgenthaler. I don't know much about this band. I just like that their name is Me, Mom, and Morgenthaler. And I've listened to Racist Friend, and I think it's like not a bad message, you know. It's basically like, I think the main lyric is, if you have a racist friend, it's time for this friendship to end. And I agree
wholeheartedly. I saw them in 1991 at a very raucous and very fun time back in the day.
That's amazing. And,
this was a bit of a throwback for me, so I'm going to enjoy hearing it.
I'm so glad.
Choke them or they shot them, then say it's bad apples. The whole barrel spoiled rotten. It's way past time to stop making excuses. pieces. It's time to drop these losers. My people are more than collateral damages of red lines, hate crimes. Can I speak to the manager? Who got it on camera, but still some denier. It's time to speak up, they stay quiet. You can't stand by it and expect that I would be a friend. It's time to bring this to an end.
Welcome back. I hope that had you up a little bit, dancing to some ska there with me, Mom, and Morgenthaler. Very appropriately named song for my guest today, who is Rachel Cairns, creator of a new podcast series on abortion in Canada called Abortion. You're listening to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM, Campus Community Radio, and I am Robin Erickson. I want to turn the discussion a little bit to how you think the conversations that promote a widespread abortion ban in the United States contribute to the anti-choice movement here in Canada, and what you see and how you see this impacting us today and how it might shape our future. Not to make you grit your teeth about it or anything.
It's certainly a bummer. I do think that there's a lot of cross-border cultural pollination that we need to be like aware of and call out. You know, Trump gets elected and shortly thereafter so does Jason Kenney and Doug Ford, and they have an insurrection on a year later where our capital is occupied for a month. So, you know, we certainly see these copycat cultural patterns. That being said, I do think Canada's has completely different political and legal systems. So I don't think that we are, you know, I don't think it's helpful. I just don't think the overturning of Roe would ever happen here. We can talk about that like more thoroughly if you'd like, but I think that certainly we need to be very cognizant of how we are talking about abortion. And it kind of goes back to what I said previously of like, stop framing it in relation to its opposition. You know, like we have countless polls for many decades now that demonstrate that the majority of the population fully supports abortion. So why do we keep on framing it as this controversial, polarizing thing when it totally isn't, you know? And instead, how about we frame it next to, you know, how we're going to make sure that housing is also a basic human right for our population. How are we going to frame it next to what our governments are actually spending money on when it comes to environmental policy? You know, so frame it next to, you know, actual other related human rights issues. And let's stop pretending that there are two sides to human rights, because there aren't. There's either you're oppressing them or you have them. and we know what side is the right side to be on. So it's so deeply infuriating. I can't even imagine how I would feel if I was, you know, a United States citizen right now. I would be just trying to figure out how I could get a job in any other country but my own, I think. That being said, you also have to like stay and fight because you'll just go somewhere else and shit will happen. But anyways, yeah, I think that we need to be, you know, here for our American allies. I'm certainly somebody that's like, you know, when Trudeau said something to the extent of like, you know, Americans can come to Canada and get abortions, I'm also like, of course. We also have access problems here. So if Americans are coming in, our governments on federal, provincial, and municipal levels really need to be putting their money where their mouth is and expanding and enshrining and ensuring access for all Canadians and Americans if they need to come up here.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Just getting to the sort of final moments in our hour, the time always goes by so fast. I want to know what responses you had hoped for, or that you do still hope for, with the release of the podcast Abortion. What do you hope it elicits in people? And what message do you hope gets across to your listening audience?
My hope in like making the project and putting it out into the world was really to, in my own way, contribute to like the destigmatizing and the normalization of abortion. You know, I kind of think of it as like the Me Too of abortion. You know, like, I've had an abortion. It's not a big deal and a big deal at the same time. And like, let's talk about it. I hope people, like I said earlier, like understand reproductive rights and choice in relation to issues that affect us all, and also therefore see reproductive rights and choice as something that affects them too. You know, like, kind of like in my response to the last question, this thing about two-sidesing it, I sometimes have a bit of a gripe because CBC still has this tendency to do both sides journalism. And, you know, it upsets me not only because of the whole, like, you can't two sides human rights thing, but also I'm like, CBC, you are an institution that has benefited from the expertise, knowledge, and wisdom of people, men, women, non-binary, trans, everyone, who has been able to decide if and when they wanted to have families, i.e. get an education, build their careers, get to a place where they can be hired by the CBC. So it's like, you've directly, and this goes for all industries, corporations, you know, you've all directly benefited from people being able to decide if and when they want to have kids. It's like kind of the foundation of modern society, really, if we're unpacking it. So, yeah, like, it's not just a woman's issue or an issue for people at a very particular part of their life. It's something that is very much a continuum in life and is something that affects everyone, whether you can have a baby or not. So yeah, I think that is, if we can get people to see it that way, that will be a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we can't say enough about really the complexity that goes into the decisions to have abortions and the complexity that is on the other side of having had an abortion, and the complexity of understanding how being able to have access to abortion reflects in terms of what modernity and you know, our society, the way that we know it, is, for sure, as you pointed out. We are going to start airing Abortsh, as I said at the beginning of the interview here, on Monday, August the 1st at 10 o'clock a.m. And it'll run for 10 consecutive weeks. So I'm very excited. And hopefully listeners who are tuned in to this interview will be able to tune in and hear the podcast on the station. Do you want to give us the details of where else folks can find out information? And then I know you've got one last song to leave us with.
Absolutely. So you can listen to Abortsh on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you normally get your podcasts. If you want to check out the website, it's www.abortsh.com. And I'm an Instagram person. That's kind of the only place where I'm really active on social media. And the handle is at Abortsh, A-B-O-R-S-H, pod, P-O-D.
Fantastic. And yeah. the song that we're going to go out on.
Yes. So this is a song by Amanda Palmer, and it's called Voicemail for Jill. And it's a song about abortion. And I'm pretty sure she wrote it shortly after the woman in Ireland passed away a few years ago, before the referendum where they, you know, decriminalized it. And really sad story, basically died of a miscarriage, where she really needed, what she needed was a procedure that was deemed to be an abortion, and would have saved her life, but couldn't get it. So Amanda wrote this, and it's pretty profound, I think.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
It's Amanda just waving from London. I know that you're going tomorrow, the hardest decision. And I've been on the side of the phone for a month, and I know you're inhaling, and know that I know what you're feeling. Life's such a bitch, isn't it? When you have a baby, they throw you a party. And then when you die, they get together for a cry. But no one's gonna celebrate you, no one's gonna bring you cake, and no one's gonna shower you with flowers. The doctor won't congratulate you, no one on that pavement's gonna shout at you that your heart also matters. I'm not sure that you'll get this in time. I don't know if you're checking your voicemail at all, but in case it's the morning and you're off of the Green Line and walking through Copley, I want you to stop for a second. I want you to listen. You don't need to offer the right explanation. You don't need to beg for redemption or ask for forgiveness. You don't need a courtroom inside of your head where you're acting as judge and accused and defendant and witness. It's a strange grief, but it's grief. Look at all the women in the street. You know the statistics, Jill. Even though they may not help, isn't it amazing how we can never is in an identical hell.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women in our lives, and we're looking to men like you, the men who make up our communities, to join us. You can play an active part to end violence. Visit www.whiteribbon.com. On July 23rd, experience an evening of chaotic transcendence with Tunnel Canary and fellow enigmatic cult icons Morning Coup and Gretchen Snakes as part of the Wrong Wave Festival curated by Liquidation World. Legendary Vancouver noise punk performance art band Tunnel Canary will be performing live with their original vocalist, the inimitable Ibra, for the first time since 1983. The show will happen in the back of Sunset Terrace, located at 2028 Clark Drive in Vancouver, beginning at 7 p.m. The event is pay what you can, but bring some cash for refreshment services.